You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. I want to welcome Alan Braden to Radio Tacoma and the Sound Poetry of the Northwest. You are going to enjoy some wonderful poetry that Alan Braden has to offer us. He's well known in the Northwest, born in farming country. He is right now the chair of the humanities at Tacoma Community College and has a chapbook as well as a very fine collection, A Wreath of Down and Drops of Blood, published by the University of Georgia Press. There Welcome, Alan, and please treat us to some poetry sounds.
Well, thanks for the invite. The more poems I write, the more I realize they're about place. And lately, the place has been not just the place that we live, but the place that we internalize, whether that's history as a place, experience as a place, and even attitude and pride as a place. So I was going to read a couple of poems that aren't in the book that may make it into the next book. This first poem is called What Returns. One thing about this poem is that one of my favorite topics to teach with fiction is the unreliable narrator. And so I thought about how could I do that, something similar in a poem to capitalize on that twist. What Returns. A calf born with two heads was buried under the loading chute. That was the year the barn cat's litter all had six toes for walking atop the snow. The only reason they survived at all. Easy to miss the signs then. No one missed the child trapped within the trundle bed, nor minded a bird drowned in the cistern. Outside my window, on nights of wind, that calf would not die. I could hear it, but found no mark in the snow. So often I remember the torn skin shed by a snake, that paper-thin occurrence of another life hidden away in the dresser. A life belonging to one of us, maybe you, maybe me. No one doubts this. You should know everything I've said up until now is mostly untrue. The child was afraid to play under the unmade bed. The calf was unremarkable, really, though the body is buried where I said, on account of snowfall and hunger. What returns is not as important as how it can blow back like certain weather without a trace beyond your window. The truth reinventing the child I was once, plain in a clear cut beneath a hawk, the cursive looped by its wingtips across the sky, indecipherable.
You could have fooled me that was unreliable in narration. I saw the imagery clear. It was with me while you read.
Just changes a little bit. I also tell my students to always keep their meter running, to use the analogy of, you know, not being plugged in and listening to conversations rather than listening to their earbuds and texting, to be open for those sort of windfall moments that all writers really look forward to. So this started with a little bit of overheard conversation, and I just call it a diner, but it was actually at Chaka Bras, which a lot of locals will know about. So this is PS from a diner. Those dudes one booth over deliberate what to visit in Vegas, a museum for Liberace or Cold War nuclear testing. But Liberace's closes this spring, one argues. I imagine the homeless of Nevada at cross streets and off ramps, bravoing and encoring in sequined capes or glam buckled velvet platform shoes. Next time a bomb goes off, it'll be stylish. Come easy, go easy. Sure thing, diners, these across the new West, hang on and dish up. The front door okayed for hippies and other subversives. The beloved, the unloved, here together, ordering, slurping, arguing, eavesdropping. Hipsters slouch against the formica counter. Shame on my contemporary plain-spoken shoes. Shame on the whole milk explosion in my espresso, so like a mushroom cloud. And I don't think I need to explain the title of this next one if you've been in Washington for very long. Where were you when the mountain blew? The voice on the radio continues. Stay inside, stay put, stay calm. Katie hugs her knees up to her chest. I wish he'd stop saying that, the voice on the radio. Outside, a cloud of bark dust swells the loafing shed. The voice, our feeder cattle and milk cows storm in and out. The sky tingles, the voice crackles, our breath filling with grit, sand, or soot? Not exactly. Sulfuric ash rains dimly. The voice on the radio, Patches, old Catahoulie, and the rest of our pets crowd the back porch. The radio, the voice, Sunday morning darkens, continuing its instruction.
Piece of history.
For the locals, at least.
40 years ago, where were you on that day? In the farmland?
That was Sunday morning. So we were coming back from milking cows and pitching hay. And then we had a lot of bottle calves that we would feed with milk replacer or cow's milk. And my dad and I were coming back for breakfast because the animals eat first, then the people get to eat. And typically in May on a Sunday from about 9 to noon is irrigation time. So we saw this dark cloud coming from the west, and we'd heard about Mount St. Helens and some rumblings, but didn't really put that together. So we just thought, oh, if it's going to rain, then that'll save us a day of irrigating. But by the time we were getting close to the house, the ash was starting to fall. And then we figured out exactly what was happening. But the animals didn't know what was happening. So they were kind of treating it like day and night. Our neighbor's rooster kept crowing whenever there'd be a little sunbreak because he thought it was morning. Yeah. This is another poem, East of the Mountains, about driving through, rather than taking Snoqualmie Pass, getting over the Cascades through Cayuse Pass and Highway 12, and then driving through some small orchard towns, Natchez and Gleed. Mm-hmm. Poem on July 4th. Once we hit orchard country, the signs grow taller than ladders. Fruit, wood, feed, camp. Migrants squat in the old Grange Hall. The elks, the lions, long extinct. Then the lumber yard closed down. Halfway flat campground delivers as promised. We ache and creak in the morning, piss the fire out after breakfast, drive east again. I tell Boone how firefighters who promised to save R's cabin joked and let it burn. He said his dad used to skid lodgepole pine near there. We pass Buena's hop kiln, born again as winery. Piety Flats, misnamed by developers. burial grounds move twice for an on-ramp. Next spreads waving amber wheat, parched as tinder. Tonight, we set the sky on fire to remember freedom. One of the worst things farmers want to encounter is an excess of alkali or lack of nitrogen in the soil. And it almost got to the point where alkali was a tangible physical presence or an enemy of any growing thing, really. So this is called alkali. The muscular flank of winter drifts as white as saddle sweat, a lather worked from mile after free mile until only Laramie at 20 below can recall those bright slopes of alkali. Acres were there for the taking, so we took them, every rotten inch. Even Scab Prairie didn't come easy. Locals gave in. Frontier stood fast, choking out row after row of red potato. That alkali, that friend to sage and horsetail, jimson and pigweeds, scalded all the nitrogen away and did in its unfair share of claims for a birthright. We wagoned down and said home, but that alkali did not budge one bit. Cursed the West, soured water in the well, and set the deed on fire.
Bit of history of dirt, soils. Did you find poets in your rural homeland when you were growing up? How did you first become acquainted with poetry or the need for poetry in your life?
Well, fiction writing came first. My dad was an old storyteller and had lots of stories about growing up working on sheep camps and when he and his brothers were working the farm. And then a lot of our neighbors and hired help that were Native American. He had some of their stories as well. And then my mother had a degree in journalism and was an avid reader. So I was surrounded by stories in one way or another. So I started writing genre fiction basically when I was 10 until about my last year as an undergrad. And then a couple of things happened in my life and happened in school that redirected me to poetry. So I left to check out some schools in the Southwest and South, and I didn't know any writers when I left. So when I came back is when I started making some poet friends in the Tacoma area. But in grad school, I did my thesis on Richard Hugo. And he was still is a strong influence in my work because there's a lot of the parallels with the Native Americans and the small towns and just that time period where the suburbs are gobbling up these small communities. And he writes so beautifully about all of that.
Right. Have you gone to his Hugo house to hear poetry or to read yourself?
Yes. Both. The very first year, they've moved since then, but I think it was in the late 90s when they opened, they had a festival kind of celebrating him. And so I was involved in that, volunteering, and then it was either on a panel or co-taught some session there. The thing I liked the best was part of that festival was we got in a school bus and a high school buddy of Hugo's rode around with us and pointed out different landmarks. Because the house where he grew up is gone now. It's just a gravel lot. But the schools and the taverns and the ballparks, because he is really into ball playing too. And then we stopped at the Duwamish because he's written quite a bit about that as well. Mm-hmm. But I haven't been to the new Hugo House. I need to check it out.
Mm-hmm. He was known also for epistolary poetry, wasn't he? Did he influence you in that way?
Not at first. I thought they were his weakest poems out of the life's work. Mm-hmm. But as I get older and as I kind of let some air in between the words and loosen up a little bit, I appreciate them more. And whenever I travel, I try to see if I can record something about the experience in what I call postcard poems. So I've written some about the South and spent a month in Chicago, and that was pretty fruitful. And then also some, we tracked down some distant family in Southern Norway. So I've written a few poems about that area. But so we're talking about place again. Mm-hmm.
The Chicago School of Arts, you did a residency in Chicago?
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. I stayed in the dorms downtown so I could walk to the Art Institute, mm-hmm. Walk to the Natural History Museum, which I think one of those, maybe it was the Field Museum, but one of those had a great Da Vinci exhibit while I was there. And the other one had King Tut exhibit, which was also really cool. And the Art Institute, I could go as often as I wanted. So it was really nice to just hang out in the 20th century American mm-hmm. art room while these other people are just rushing through it so they can see, you know, the most famous, the Southern Gothic and Nighthawks and Georgia O'Keeffe, and say that they've been there.
Have you written any poems that are related to artworks?
I have, and a couple of photograph poems. I have a poem about Dorothea Lange, a poem about Walker Evans, a poem about a Van Gogh painting, and then probably the largest project that I've been working on off and on is Andrew Wyeth, his life and his work, which really appeals to me just because of the rural aspect and the realism and the fact that he was making those paintings when the rest of the art world was going in such a different direction. I think that's pretty amazing that he stuck with it for 70 years.
Do you feel that your poetry is going in the right direction with its emphasis on nature, whether it's the tame land of the farm or the wild of the animals and birds?
I think nature is making a comeback in the form of eco-poetry and eco-literature and eco-anything you can think of. All of the genres kind of are dabbling with that as well. And you can see that in the publishing world too. There's a lot of little literary magazines that just have a nature focus or an environmental focus or sustainability. Many more than there was, say, in the 90s.
There was a transition at one time. There was much nature in the poetry of the middle of the 20th century. I think of Ted Hughes, and in comparison with some of your imagery, it evokes that kind of concern about the details of natural life. And after Ted Hughes, there seemed to be passing away of a lot of focus on on the hedgerow and the birds.
I'd agree with that, except maybe in the American South. And maybe because their writers tend to embrace regionalism and history more than other groups of writers. You know, we can get in trouble generalizing on one group or another, but that has been my impression. And then when you were talking about when this was happening, it made me wonder if some of that, looking at place and looking at the outside world, literally, was a response or a reaction to all the confessional poetry that was happening, where there's only so many mental illness poems one can read. So opening the windows and letting the fresh air in would make sense. Yeah. But it's always changing, that's what's exciting. And you can't ever pin it down, which I think is the wonderful thing and the frustrating thing about literature. It doesn't fit into a box. No.
Well, read some more. It'd be interesting to hear. We've got 10 more minutes that you can proceed to regale us with your poems.
I'll read a poem or two from my chapbook, Elegy in the Passive Voice. Well, I guess I'll read this first poem because it's an Andrew Wyeth poem, Imagery. Every gradation of ash and dust imaginable offers a deer that dangles from a branch somewhere in the dead of Delaware winter. Offers a pig's head, motionless on a meat hook, dripping onto several casks of aged cider. Allegories for anyone who might care to peer unflinchingly, closely enough, beyond doors left ajar into blank rooms, or through gauzy squares of window light, at how the past can shape the future. A pair of blackbirds nailed to the barn door, the glass globe lit up blue from lightning, or coils of rope and chain, its hook and clevis, tools for sickling wheat or skinning a carcass, whatever labor a father's hands have known. Never a spot of crimson save one smudge of gore on his chop block. No blur of bright cardinal, no bouquets in opaque vases, no, not even a solitary silhouette which might be mistaken for the sun. S-O-N, not S-U-N. Let me read a shorter one just for the sake of variety. This is called Both Portraits. In his bleary memory, she poses like an immaculate mannequin, her eyes pimentos, joints frozen in a gesture he's grown to know. Loss is like a blue bottle fly buzzing around in a mug of bourbon. She'll come back any minute, he keeps telling himself. One day pours into the next, but he can still see her, the dark square nailed to the wall, a portrait taken down for good.
In some of your poems, you have a title that begins with On the Taboo Against the Word Beauty. What is your idea there of the taboo on the word beauty?
Well, that's a great question. And I think I'm still trying to figure it out, which is why I wrote those 16 poems that are all sonnet-like. I wouldn't call them sonnets, because a purist would balk at that. But they're all 14 lines, and they all have some sort of a turn. But one of the cliches in workshop is there's certain concepts or even words like soul or void I see a lot in student work. That becomes a sort of cliche in poetry, and writing about beauty is one of those. So I was trying to come at beauty as a sort of praise of the unexpected, whether that's through artwork or, for me, I know the natural world the best. So the nature and even the sort of what we see as brutal cycles, having that play out and just the mastery and precision of our lives and the natural world is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of beauty. But I wish I could explain it better than that. I suppose I could read one or two.
You don't avoid the word beauty in the some of those poems, although not always does it appear.
Well, it's funny because before this, when you mentioned Elegy, the first book review of this book, the editor said that the poet seemed obsessed with elegy. And it was as
an elegy, an elegiac in what sense?
Not a good thing.
In the
death, I guess loss.
Deathly, the dying of.
This is called Taboo Against the Word Beauty. Version with a flintlock rifle triggered repeatedly. That crack along the mahogany stock recollects the explosive story of a boy loading pure black powder by accident who was blown from this page to the next. The gunpowder, on the other hand, alleges a true and contrary version, same as the barrel forged in the past perfect tense, like spilt salt thrown for luck. Lead buckshot once peppered the frozen air of innumerable autumns. Coveys brought down, or snowshoe hares, their stories slung onto the table one by one. Other times, the hammer struck its flint to spark the blood in words like feud, war. And here's one, since we were talking about Chicago. It's called Taboo Against the Word Beauty, epistolary version, writing the Chicago loop. Dear Kevin, the elevated train's not called L, but L, as in lucky, lonely, or love. In a posh bar, Beauty kept reaching across her husband to stroke my arm. They'd been married long enough, he didn't mind or notice. No kidding about love on Dearborn, either. Give with your heart, not your wallet. Seems everyone on the street has needs. Spare change, sponsor a child, hold me. One man shows me the scar on his face, a knife fight in prison. He knows I have mercy. Anymore, he's that pane of glass detached from Walgreens' windowsill. I look through it, then step around.
Contemporary in many ways, that one. Yes. Do you want to read one more of the book, or if you would like to read something in conclusion that you'd picked out, make it your own choice.
Okay, I'd be happy to. Let's go with the title poem for A Wreath of Down and Drops of Blood. It's called The Hemlock Tree. Did I mention that last night an owl swept down from her perch in the hemlock nearby to devour a wild dove tamed by Safeway birdseed? Of course, I can reconstruct the scene for you from knowing how this testimony beyond the limits of your city implies the inevitable circuit of hunger, from knowing how all life must enter into a kind of covenant with nature, for the living shall consume the flesh of the living, and from the delicate evidence at hand, a wreath of down, drops of blood. And right now, you might be wondering about the wisteria spiraling up that hemlock, inching a bit higher with each passing year, offering loveliness in powder blue clusters for a few weeks of May, and all the while killing the tree with its gradual, constrictive, necessary beauty.
Thank you, Alan. You've been listening to the very fine verse of Tacoma Community College Chair of the Humanities, Alan Braden, and we thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.